If they say three-layer mask is better, I don't want to play guessing games with old t-shirts. I want a certified cloth mask that I can purchase.
COVID-19 messaging has been muddled from the start. Can it improve in time to make a difference? From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. We also have a vaccine supply problem, but companies that could make them are hamstrung by patent laws.
They don't have that option unless Moderna or Pfizer are prepared to give that to them. Patents are a form of monopoly. Unless we change the policy, there's not much we could do about that.
Plus, how Redditors day traded a meme stock into the heavens, upending Wall Street, mostly for the lulz.
Wall Street bets recognized that if they collectively decided to elevate GameStop stock, they could do it.
Stay tuned.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is off this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. So, a new COVID safety precaution has been making the rounds. Double masking.
So if you have a physical covering with one layer, you put another layer on, it just makes common sense.
Sound advice. Why are we only hearing it a year into the pandemic? Here's Dr. Fauci back in March of 2020.
China and South Korea, whatever, everybody's wearing a mask. Right now in the United States, people should not be walking around with masks.
But East Asia's had more experience with SARS viruses than us, wouldn't they know?
The coronavirus outbreak is prompting the U.S. Surgeon General to make a desperate plea to the public. Stop buying masks. They're not effective in preventing general public from catching coronavirus.
Do you sense that maybe the authorities didn't trust us to do the right thing, like saving medical-grade masks for frontline healthcare workers? Maybe their impulse was right, but their method was so wrong.
Wearing a mask might make people feel a little bit better, and it might even block a droplet, but it's not providing the perfect protection that people think that it is.
Our own Dr. Fauci even said they carry certain risks.
And often, there are unintended consequences. People keep fiddling with the mask, and they keep touching their face.
Wearing a mask can also keep you from touching your face. But some physicians disparaged mask wearing as akin to carrying a rabbit's foot. Others suggested it might give us a false sense of security.
The Chicago Medical Society is worried that a call for general mask wearing will reduce social distancing.
Meanwhile, taking mask myths to another level, Texas Republican Representative Louie Gohmert blamed his mask for giving him the virus. Darn mask.
I can't help but wonder if by keeping a mask on and keeping it in place that if I might have put some germs, some of the virus onto the mask and breathed it in.
Muddled messaging in Europe and the States spread confusion and suspicion, reckless optimism and hopeless pessimism, first over masking, then over vaccines, now over the variant strains. There are consequences to withholding the full truth, even to get the public to behave itself.
It creates this opportunity for mistrust, especially if the authorities don't really come clean.
Zeynep Tufekci is associate professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and contributing writer at The Atlantic and The New York Times.
They did kind of say, well, the evidence changed, but Hong Kong and Taiwan clearly had evidence. So the evidence hasn't really changed. It's more like, well, we were behind the evidence, which is more honest.
In your newsletter, Insight, on Substack, you quote David Leonhardt of the New York Times, who says, a version of the mask story is repeating itself. This time, he said, it involves the vaccines. Once more, the experts don't seem to trust the public to hear the full truth. What is the truth that we're not hearing?
What he's trying to get at is the framing around the vaccines. We have hit unexpected, amazing home runs with these vaccines. The first two that have been authorized in the United States, the Pfizer BioNTech and Moderna, you don't get any COVID at all for 95% of the people. And for the rest of the 5% in both the Moderna trial and the Pfizer trial, there's about 60,000 people total. Out of that 60,000 total, there was a single severe case among someone who was vaccinated.
Even among the 5% for whom it wasn't, quote, effective, their cases were mild except for a single case.
One case qualified as severe, and her clinical description was that her oxygen saturation got down to 93%, but she didn't need any other medical attention. She didn't need to be hospitalized, and that's the only case. Now, contrast that with the messages full of, well, we don't yet know if they prevent transmission, or you can't take your masks off yet, or you can't do this and you can't do that. Those things aren't completely false, but they have to be framed correctly. We do think it's going to blunt transmission. We just don't have an exact number yet. In the preliminary study, Moderna found that even asymptomatic infection was down by 2/3. So that's really strongly suggesting that it's going to blunt transmission somewhat. Publicly, we'll probably be wearing masks for a while because in public, you don't want to create two classes of people, and you also don't know like who's vaccinated. But of all the things to emphasize right now, we have vaccines that are better than anything we had hoped for, basically almost complete elimination of severe disease. So instead of celebrating this, because life is going to get back to normal when enough of us are vaccinated, it's full of headlines warning people about all the short-term limits. And a lot of anti-vaxxers have latched onto this, saying, if the vaccines are so good, why are there so many articles warning you nothing's going to change? People are tired and fatigued. And when we didn't get our mask messaging right, we damaged compliance and masking. And when we don't communicate the real upsides of the vaccines, when we don't get our messaging right, we do damage to trust.
Now come the COVID variants, and let's start with the ones first encountered in the UK and South Africa. I mean, we should be worried about a more infectious strain. They are 50 to 70% maybe more transmissible. We were also told, though, at the same time that they were not more deadly, but it seems that if you have more cases, it means more deaths. And I recently heard on the BBC that these strains may, in fact, be more deadly. But you've taken issue with the worries that the media are now choosing to spotlight, right?
Right. I started seeing the data, and I thought, oops, we got adaptive evolution here. Question number one is, what do I do in the short term? You have to up your precautions. Because if it's transmitting 50% more than it used to, it means that the environment that you got away with last time, you're 50% less likely to get away with. We also have seasonality working against us, right? These coronaviruses are usually seasonal. This one appears to be so. So we have, you know, the winter dry air. Well, what about the vaccine? Moderna came out with a study which was really encouraging, which showed that while both variants, UK one less so, and the South African one is a little more dangerous, they were lowering the neutralizing antibodies. But neutralizing antibodies are but one part of the immune system, and they were so high to begin with, they were clearing the bar. So what we were hearing was that, you know what? It's going to work.
So when you objected to the San Francisco Chronicle writing, Moderna's coronavirus vaccine protected against the mutations of the virus first detected in Britain and South Africa, but the antibodies were 6 times less effective at neutralizing the South African variant, it made it sound like it was
six times less effective. They gave you the very wrong impression. The thing that went down sixfold is the neutralizing antibodies. That doesn't really translate into vaccine efficacy. I mean, I realize this is kind of getting into technical weeds of immunology, but if you're writing a headline, that's what you should know. if you just put the six-fold decrease in the headline, you're going to freak people out because people are going to think, wait, like, did we go from, you know, 90% to 30%?
So how effective is it?
Most people think it might go from, say, 95% to, say, 90%. Nobody's expecting to go down to 30%. So the correct message is you and I should not be discussing neutralizing antibodies. It's not the public's area of expertise. And I'm just telling you what the scientists have told me. It will have a small effect. Plus, Moderna said they were working on a booster for the new variants. And a lot of people were saying, well, if they're working on a booster, that means this one doesn't work. Whereas they clearly said, you know, we're just kind of keeping an eye on this. So my sense from seeing that press release and the paper, they put the paper out too, I was like, this is great. And they're already working on the booster. That's exactly what they should be doing.
Some other framings you didn't like. Vaccines have been oversold as the pandemic exit strategy, from the Financial Times and a tweet from NPR, which said Moderna finds COVID-19 vaccine less effective against variant.
It's fine to say the efficacy will take a marginal hit. And also to tell people the variant is a real threat. You're unvaccinated now if you're like most Americans. You got to be more careful. Let's be straight. Let's say the good stuff. Let's not give misleading information. Let's not put six-fold decrease in neutralizing antibodies in a headline as if that's something the public should be expected to understand. And that's going to make people not want to take the vaccine when they should jump at it. The media has to examine how it switches. Like there's this herding effect where they dismissed the pandemic risk. They dismiss masks. They did this for a long time. And then when it flipped, there's a lot of doomsaying now. I'm seeing articles saying vaccination's not going to get us out of it. Yes, it will. The problem is we don't have enough.
You've said that the confused messaging, the wrong messages were being spread by officials long after the evidence was in. You wrote, maybe worst of all is the willful amnesia. It sometimes feels as if these failures were never made, as if we all just updated our COVID-related guidelines when the evidence came in. In reality, you said, most Western nations were tragically lagging in their response. Also the WHO.
You know, I talked about the CDC and the World Health Organization being late with mask guidance. We also didn't get ventilation guidance till fall. And it was a confusing thing with the CDC. We got something posted and then got it deleted and it got back. And I wrote an article about ventilation in July. Then I got inundated by people who were trying to plan how to open schools back, all sorts of things like that. And they're like, nobody told us any of this because it wasn't part of the CDC guidelines. And the World Health Organization kept like talk about hand washing and disinfecting, which has a place, but it doesn't make sense to disinfect every surface and not open a window when we know that makes a difference. There are all these things in which we were late, and I know that we were late because Japan wasn't late. Hong Kong wasn't late. The amnesia part is that once we catch up, we act like nothing happened. They just sort of say, we got more evidence. Well, you know what? Japan had mass guidance, aerosol transmission, over dispersion, which is like the clustering, in February, right? Why did it take us till fall? And with the World Health Organization, it took till December of 2020 before they started telling people to wear a mask indoors, regardless of distancing. Like that's 10 months late. So there has been no explanation or searching of what on earth has been going on.
So this comes back to your first point about accountability.
And even if it's partly because, you know, they were working under really difficult conditions with the president, we still need that conversation. And with the World Health Organization, that's a whole other thing. Like, we need that conversation because these are institutions we need to trust. You know, the National Transportation Board, they do these no-blame postmortems where the emphasis is in trying to understand exactly what went wrong.
Lessons learned. The military does it too.
Lessons learned rather than just, you know, fire people. We need that because, you know, for all my criticisms, they're excellent organizations.
They're all we have.
And they are what we need right now with the new administration. Like, I know it's been just a week, but it's urgent. We need our public health authorities to give us clear, actionable guidance on if they say three-layer mask is better. I don't want to play guessing games with old t-shirts. I want a certified cloth mask that I can purchase. If somebody's high risk or in a poorly ventilated environment, I want them to be able to say, where can I buy an N95? How do I best put it on? How do I take it off? How do I reuse it? They're not like some failing organization overall. They're amazing people. Whatever happened last year, on the whole, they're, of course, more right than wrong.
Zeynep Tufekci is associate professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and contributing writer at The Atlantic and The New York Times. Coming up, the perils of intellectual property during a plague. This is On the Media. This is Brooke. When you finish listening to OTM this week, why don't you head over to the New Yorker Radio Hour? My colleague David Remnick sat down with Jerry Seinfeld, who just directed his first movie.
This is the only idea I've ever had for a film.
Really?
I never get asked to do a film.
Really?
Never.
You know, you really should listen to the New Yorker Radio Hour.
So please, do what Brooke says. Come join us for the New Yorker Radio Hour wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Vaccine shortages across the country.
States and cities like New York are desperate for more supply.
We're now nearly at 4,000 people dying in the U.S. every day.
Labyrinthine vaccination signups, lack of transparency, canceled appointments. If the pathway through this pandemic is vaccines, it's a dark and twisted one. For all the issues with distribution, and there are issues, there is equally an issue with supply. President Biden announced this week that his administration is working to buy an additional 200 million doses of the vaccines. But as Dean Baker, senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, explains, we're still constrained by the matter of who can actually manufacture them.
Moderna, Pfizer own a patent. And what that means is that no one else could produce them without getting a license from those two companies. So while in principle, we might think that there are other companies that either have the manufacturing capacity or could develop it, they don't have that option unless Moderna or Pfizer are prepared to give that to them. Patents are a form of monopoly. Unless we change the policy, there's not much we could do about that.
And both these companies had access to hundreds of millions of dollars in public money and billions of dollars in advance purchase commitments.
Yeah, this is really striking. In the case of Moderna, we literally paid for their development of this vaccine. We gave them somewhere in the order of $430, $440 million to do the original development and then the phase one, phase two testing. And then the government put up another roughly $440 million to pay the cost of phase three testing, where they determine that it's safe and effective. And of course, the Food and Drug Administration approved that. Drug companies often say, well, they need a patent, they have to charge high prices because they took a big risk, and sometimes their drugs fail, which is true, of course. In this case, suppose the FDA looked at it and goes, it's a no-go, it's not effective, or it's not safe. Well, they were paid.
Reshma Ramachandran and Zoe Thill wrote in The Nation this week that we shouldn't be calling these Pfizer vaccines or Moderna vaccines at all. They're the people's vaccine.
We paid for them, and one of the things we really would have liked was full transparency on all of the research results. So they're giving it to the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, and I'm not saying they don't do a good job, but still, things will get through. They can't analyze everything. They're rushed, and inevitably, they will make some mistakes.
if it were fully transparent, if you had the data there so that you could look what happened to younger people, to older people, people who had heart issues, people who might have had other conditions, then researchers all over the country, all over the world would be able to go through it, and maybe they would catch something that the FDA missed.
I don't entirely understand what the data has to do with monopoly ownership of the drug, because the data refers to how it's worked out in the trials, not how it was made or what its components are or any of that.
Well, to my view, there's not a good argument for keeping the data secret, but most of the drug companies insist on that. And there's a very pernicious reason as to why they might want to keep it secret, and that's they may look to misrepresent the safety or effectiveness of their drugs. That's a big part of the story of the opioid crisis. You know, Purdue Pharma, which was one, of course, the big opioid manufacturers, if from the first day this was selling as a generic, anyone could produce it, they wouldn't have a big incentive to go out and market it and tell doctors, oh, don't worry, it's not addictive. They wouldn't be doing that. My view is, why don't we just pay for the research up front? Then you don't have that issue. And that's exactly what we did with Moderna. We paid for the research up front. We still gave them a patent monopoly, which makes zero sense. But if you pay for the research up front, then they don't have costs to cover. Currently, the government spends roughly $45 billion a year on biomedical research. If you look at what the industry spends, it's roughly $90 billion, so more or less twice that amount. Now, suppose we look to replace what the industry spends. We were spending, say, somewhere around $130, $140 billion a year in prescription drug research and development. Well, then we would have paid for the companies in advance to do the research. Once it was approved, it could be sold as a generic from the first day.
What these manufacturers become essentially are research companies. They stand to make far less money from the actual sale of the drug that they were paid to create.
And to my view, that's exactly what we want. I'm not looking to put any of these companies out of business. Pfizer, Merck, all the big companies presumably would want to stay in business. They've had years of experience doing research, so they would put in bids on these contracts. They're going to research cancer drugs. You know, in my view, if they're asking me how to design the system, everything's open source. So as soon as you get a lab result, you put it up on the web so everyone could see it.
Your scenario, which I love. It's so socialist.
It's just a different type of capitalism. I'm not concerned that they could make as much profit as they do under the current system. I mean, maybe they will. I frankly hope they don't.
You're talking about serving the public.
Yes, that's our goal in designing the system. And we always have to remember, patent monopolies are a government policy. Because again, I don't know how many times I've argued with people and they go, oh, you want to interfere with the market? I'm sorry, a patent monopoly is from the government. So we're already interfering with the markets. We're deciding how best to do it.
The situation that we're in now wasn't inevitable. Back at the beginning of the pandemic, the WHO set up a COVID-19 technology access pool to promote the sharing of knowledge. And there were early reports about how the pandemic was going to change how the world does science, make it more collaborative.
There was a lot of cooperation early on that many scientists talked about. There were a lot of developments that were posted on the web. You had international cooperation, scientists in Europe, in China, in the United States. But then we quickly huddled down. You had the company saying, okay, we're going to work on this. We're going to work on that. They wanted to get patent monopolies and have vaccines, treatments that would allow them to make lots of money. And what, in principle, we would have wanted to see was collective sharing of knowledge and also open access to technology so that when these vaccines were being developed, anyone with the means to produce the vaccines would have been able to. We would have liked to have hundreds of millions of each of these vaccines available, maybe even billions, at the point where they were approved. Maybe we would have made 800 million, a billion doses of the Pfizer vaccine, and it gets to December, and turns out FDA looks at it, and they say it's a no-go. Well, that's unfortunate, but you go, well, okay, so the vaccines cost roughly $2 each to produce. Again, not an exact figure, but a ballpark number. So we threw $2 billion in the garbage. We've spent, the U.S. alone, somewhere in the order of $5 trillion now in COVID relief.
This past October, there was a proposal put forward by India and South Africa asking the WTO to exempt member countries from some forms of intellectual property enforcement. which would allow them to produce generic versions of COVID vaccines and treatments. And that was an immediate no-go. But aren't there global provisions for emergencies just like this?
Yeah, this is a fascinating question. So the TRIPS Accords, trade-related aspect of international property, part of the WTO as of 1995, those require all countries to adopt U.S.-style patent laws, but they have special permission during emergencies to override those patent laws. That special permission has very, very rarely been invoked. And the reason for that is the United States, and I suspect European countries as well, have basically threatened retaliation.
What kind of retaliation? Denying the drugs, they're not giving them anyway?
Various forms of trade retaliation. This came up with South Africa in the 1990s. We threatened to put up tariffs because they were going to do that on a drug that was used to treat AIDS patients. And this was, I think, 99. Bill Clinton was still president then. The U.S. threatened them with retaliation where we would make it more difficult for them to export items to the U.S. Al Gore, of course, was running for president in 2000. A number of AIDS activists went to his speeches and they protested. And Clinton backed down on it because it was hurting Gore. Gore didn't want to be associated with it. I forget whether they actually issued the compulsory license because, again, you get this dance where countries threaten to issue compulsory licenses and then often to prevent that from actually happening, the company agrees to radically reduce the price. That's happened several times.
I don't know if Pfizer or Moderna or Johnson & Johnson, if that one comes out, could even do the little jig of saying, oh, no, we'll drop the prices because they can't make enough. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of potential lost lives.
The pharmaceutical industry is saying, oh, well, it's complicated technology. They couldn't possibly produce it. Well, first of all, India, Brazil, some of the other countries in the developing world, they have very high-tech manufacturers. So they're not working with sticks and rocks. India's generic manufacturers are as good as anyone in the world. Now, do they have facilities up and running? Probably not. They would have to retool them. So what's the timeline we're talking about? Well, I'm not an expert in the technology, but what we do know is none of these vaccines existed back in March of last year. And they were able to produce hundreds of millions of doses by November. What that tells us is in 8 months, we could have hundreds of millions of doses if we had new factories ready to produce the stuff, and maybe quite a bit sooner. I mean, I'd love to say that, well, 8 months would be too late. We'll already have the pandemic under control. But I don't think anyone really believes that. So if we said, okay, today, you know, we're going to allow anyone in the world who has the ability to produce this to go ahead and start converting a factory, that would be a huge thing in terms of controlling the pandemic.
But no sign of that so far.
The Trump administration, America First, they didn't care. I would hope the Biden administration would show more foresight. Humanitarian reasons are huge, but really just from self-interested reasons. I mean, look at what's happening. We're seeing variants of the virus. So even if we're successfully able to vaccinate everyone in the United States in 2021, if it's still raging in sub-Saharan Africa and Latin America, elsewhere in the world, we're going to see new variants and maybe the vaccines we have will be effective against them, but there's a chance they won't be.
Didn't Moderna agree not to enforce its patent until the pandemic was over?
They did, but the end of the pandemic is not well defined. So maybe the end of the pandemic, you know, from Moderna's standpoint, is when it's no longer widespread in the United States.
Well, then why can't India and South Africa and all those other countries have Moderna's formula now?
So if they could get in writing that as long as it's widespread anywhere in the world, then in principle, they could take up the Moderna vaccine, start producing that.
It's widespread right now.
Well, it is, but perhaps Moderna's going to say 6 months, 8 months down the road, oh, it's no longer widespread. We're pronouncing the pandemic over, and now you owe us lots of money. Put yourself in the position of a generic manufacturer in India or Brazil, and you hear this pledge from Moderna. And that's all you have, that they're not going to enforce their patent rights until the pandemic's over. And you call them up and you go, well, what does that mean? And they go, well, it means what we just said. Well, you go, well, how are you defining the end of the pandemic? Well, when we say it's over. Now, if you can get them to say, well, no, as long as if you have a lot of it in India, then it's not over. If you can get that commitment, that's great. But to my knowledge, they haven't been willing to say that.
So it was meaningless mumbo jumbo?
That's what I suspect. Again, you know, these are business people. They know how to say what they mean. And if their intention is to say, as long as the pandemic is a problem anywhere in the world, people are free to use the technology, that would be great, but that's not what they said.
Dean, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for having me on. I really enjoyed it.
Dean Baker is senior economist at the Center for Economic Policy Research. Coming up, maybe the clearest explanation of the GameStop phenom and how I played the long game. Very long. This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. So back in 1999, in my early 40s, I had a modest individual retirement account, and my account manager was Charlie, who made suggestions when I had money to invest. I must have had a speaking engagement that year or something, because I had $1,000 to put in. And he suggested that I buy 65 shares of a $15 stock, total cost $975, called GameStop. Now, following my portfolio, as it were, tends to make me bored, or worse, anxious, or worse still, greedy. So I pretty much ignore it. My husband doesn't. Back in April, he said, "You still have GameStop? It's $3.50. And I said, yeah. And just to needle him a little, I added, "Hey, you never know." When your investment shrinks from almost a grand to $50 because you ignored it, the rational move, I reckoned, was to continue ignoring it. GameStop is a corporation that sells digital cartridges containing video games, and also video game consoles and other fun widgets, from brick-and-mortar stores to flesh-and-blood customers. It's a thing of the natural world, and so must abide by its physical laws. The stock, on the other hand.
Video game retailer GameStop is set to continue their head-spinning ascent today. Shares are now up
going
more than
absolutely nuts. If you look at the, if you just look at the volume in the last few days, there's never been anything like it in its history.
For most of last year, the company was worth a pretty dismal $250 million. But GameStop's stock has soared upward into the exosphere, ballooning the company's worth to somewhere in the ballpark of $20 billion. Did it suddenly have a new strategy to overcome the fact that people could download most of what it sells? That in-person retail, sagging for years, had plunged into a virus-induced toilet? Would even that cause the crazy speculation we've witnessed? No, runs like that are fueled not by reality, but by phantoms. Like housing bubbles, imaginary investment instruments, dreams of catching a moving train into the sky after it's run out of steam. At least that used to be why it happened. But now there's a new reason. Spite. All this is best explained not by corporate actions or the current state of the actual American economy, but rather, as James Surowiecki explained this week in Marker, as a meme. And you may remember other recent meme stocks. Kodak, for instance.
There's usually some kind of catalyst that gets them interested. In Kodak's case, for instance, there was this very odd rumor that they were going to get involved with drugs to deal with COVID. And that sort of got people buying it. And in GameStop's case, the catalyst was really two things. One is, you know, people were saying it was pretty undervalued. Its stock had been driven down very, very low. And then in the summer, a new guy came on board the board, a guy named Ryan Cohen, who had helped make a company called Chewy very successful. He has all these ambitions to, you know, move GameStop into e-commerce. So that kind of got people talking about it. And maybe the kind of center of the meme stock universe has become a subreddit, a board on Reddit called Our Wall Street Bets. It actually now has, I think, more than 2 million subscribers. And it's really just a place where people come and talk about usually sort of bad companies that could make interesting bets. But what has happened over the last year is that they sort of have realized the power that they potentially have, that even though, you know, most of them, I assume, don't, at least it sounds like when you read it, don't have a ton of money. When you aggregate all of their buying power, they suddenly have the ability to move stocks. So the other thing that's important about meme stocks is generally they all have had two characteristics. They've all been cheap. The vast majority, maybe all of them, have had stock prices in the single digits at the time that they really first started to get going. And then the other thing about them is that they were all heavily shorted. In other words, short sellers were betting strongly against them.
Give us a brief explanation of short selling.
So the vast majority of investors, the vast amount of money that's in the stock market, is betting that stocks will rise. Short sellers do the opposite. They bet that stocks will fall. So they try to identify companies where the business is bad or where they think the stock price has gotten totally out of control. They borrow shares from someone who actually owns the stock, and then they sell them. Their hope is that the stock price will fall, and then they can buy back the shares at a lower price and return them to the person they borrowed them from. The ideal trade would be you short the stock at 20, it drops to 10, you buy back the shares, and you know, you've made basically $10 a share. The danger for short sellers is that in theory, their losses are unlimited. If you buy GameStop at $5 a share, the most you can lose is $5 a share, right? I mean, it could go to zero and you would lose $5 a share. If you short GameStop, as a lot of shorts did, if you short it at $20 a share and it goes to $290 a share, which is where GameStop was a few minutes ago, and you hold on to your short that whole time, you've just lost $270 a share. So your losses are, in theory, unlimited. And it makes it, A, very hard to be a short seller. Psychologically, it's very hard to do.
You need a strong stomach.
Yeah, you need an incredible level of pain tolerance. The basic problem for a short is that if they don't want to hold on to that stock all the way up to 290, at some point, they just decide, I can't take the pain anymore. I got to close out my short. So I have to buy the stock back. But when they do that, it actually sends the stock higher, right? There's all this demand. If there are still people shorting it, which there usually are, that actually inflicts more pain on them. And so they start to say, you know what? I can't take the pain. They buy the stock. That sends the stock higher. And that's what's usually called a short squeeze. And that was a big part of what has driven GameStop's stock higher.
Now, you said that people, they don't like short sellers. They're seen as the Darth Vaders of the market by a lot of people because they're betting that stocks will go down. They're buzzkills.
Yeah.
But the Redditors seem to think that they are just bad guys. Alex Kirshner in Slate quoted some of the Reddit posts. When these boomers made their bet, GameStop wasn't a big thing on Wall Street bets yet. I don't feel bad at all, said another, taking money from these rich, greedy hedge fund managers. I'm an old millennial. I'm tired of getting screwed by the globalist elites, another one said. This isn't left or right, Republican or Democrat. It's the 1% versus everyone else.
Yeah, there definitely is a real sense of basically taking it to the man. So there was a hedge fund that had, I think, the biggest short position in GameStop, Melvin Capital. Earlier this week, Melvin Capital had to be bailed out. It basically got a $3 billion, almost $3 billion injection of equity from two other hedge funds. The celebration on Wall Street Bets was pretty palpable. I mean, they had essentially, you know, toppled this hedge fund. And, you know, there's a sense that a lot of people have that Wall Street is basically a corrupt insider's game. And they're not entirely wrong about that. It's a game where bigwigs are able to prosper even as everybody else doesn't. You know, obviously over the last 10 years, a lot of people have gotten rich in the stock market and a lot of ordinary people have too. But that clearly is a dominant image of Wall Street and it's not an incorrect one. And so what this has become for a lot of people, both people who are actually doing the trading and then also people observing it, is a kind of populist revolt. Wall Street is finally getting what it deserves. I actually do think there is a real resonance between what's happening in GameStop and other stocks like it and what happened in 2016 with, you know, sort of the meme lords on places like 4chan and Reddit, and the way they really tried to sort of, and did, disrupt the traditional media narrative, the traditional way the media covered the campaign, the way sort of politics worked.
How did they disrupt it?
What they were able to do was use social media to spread pro-Trump, but really anti-Hillary memes that I think helped make really powerful the image of Hillary as a corrupt insider who stood for everything that, you know, the internet was and millennials were not in favor of. And, you know, we can debate about how effective those memes were. But when Trump won, there was this one poster on 4chan who posted, "We actually elected a meme president." Slightly overstated, obviously, but there certainly was a dimension to that that was accurate. Although that was really driven by kind of an alt-right perspective, and that's very different from what's happening with Wall Street Bets. That sense that you can leverage social media, that communities can self-organize and can then really go out and accomplish really interesting things, there I think is a real resonance between 2016 and what we're seeing right now.
Your reference to the meme president is particularly interesting because the virtual world and the world inside of our own heads has merged so much with the in-real-life world. And of course, the stock market, money in general, has always existed principally in our own heads.
You know, the stock market is kind of the perfect place for these kinds of for these kinds of projects to sort of play themselves out. There's nothing imaginary about the businesses underlying the stocks, but stocks always have a certain kind of fantastical element to them. The continued ascent of Bitcoin, which is in a way a kind of perfect example of collective willing something into existence. I mean, you know, Bitcoin's value depends entirely on the fact that people think Bitcoin is valuable. And as a result, it really is that valuable. This group of people on this subreddit and other message boards kind of recognized that if they collectively decided to elevate GameStop stock, they could do it.
Is this kind of manipulation, strictly speaking, legal?
It's a fascinating question that I don't think we have a clear answer to. It's not obvious who you would hold responsible for the illegality. You know, there's a long history of people organizing pools, you know, to buy stocks to drive them up or alternatively to sell stocks to drive them down. That was very characteristic of the 19th century and then the early 20th century.
The uranium stocks in the 50s and the RV stocks in the 60s and the dot-com stocks in the 90s. Maybe the tulip bubble in the 1600s.
Yeah.
Is that what you're talking about? Or is this something else?
This is something else. I mean, that's one of the really important points to make about this, that what we're seeing with GameStop and other stocks like AMC, the theater company, which on Wednesday quadrupled by midday, despite the fact that we are in a pandemic and no one is actually going to the movies. What we're seeing with these stocks is very different from what we've seen in past bubbles. In past bubbles, it was really a function of investors believing that a certain set of companies was going to sort of transform the world. So, yeah, uranium stocks in the 1950s, or my favorite is the bowling stock bubble of the early 1960s. People became convinced that every American was going to become a bowler. And that feeds on itself because as, you know, stock prices rise, other people say, oh, wait, maybe I should buy them, and they get in. But it isn't an organized or strategic effort to drive stocks up. What is distinctive about what we're seeing this week is the essence of it was a kind of strategic recognition that if enough people got together to buy GameStop stock and drove the price up, then they could create a short squeeze. And if they traded options in a clever way, that would help drive the stock up. And in that sense, it actually looks much more like what we used to see in the 19th century and the early 20th century, what were sometimes called bull raids, where a pool of investors would basically connive amongst themselves to buy stocks in order to pump up the price in the idea that that would then lure other buyers in and they could sort of ride it up and then dump it at the top. What's happening in GameStop is people recognizing we can do this thing and then going ahead and doing it without anyone being in charge, which is one of the reasons why I think it's so fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Elon Musk has been tweeting about various stocks. Not long ago, I guess, the messaging app Signal, and then a lot of investors flocked to the wrong company, also called Signal, that was defunct. And was this fun? Was this intentional? People made or lost a lot of money there.
Yeah, so I actually think the impact that Elon Musk is having on the stock market is probably a little closer to bubbles we've seen in the past. During the dot-com bubble, for instance, companies that added dot-com to their name or something similar almost always saw their stock prices jump simply because they added dot-com to their name. But even with the Elon Musk thing, I think there is a level of...
Are you saying he is like appending dot-com to your name?
It isn't so much that Elon Musk says it and then everyone says, okay, well, that must mean it's worth buying. I think there's also an element of, if Elon Musk says it, then people will think they should buy. So therefore, I will buy to cash in on that. And then other people say, if other people are going to buy. And so there is a kind of positive feedback loop. And that was the case with the Signal Advance story. And then more recently, Tuesday after the market closed, he didn't even really say much about GameStop. He just said, "Game stonk." And that, I think, helped get the market going again. So Musk definitely has this kind of ability to move markets.
So do you think that the Redditors have permanently altered some fundamental aspect of American capitalism?
Yeah, on the simplest level, if you are a short seller, you have to be much warier today than you were a week ago. You just have to be. And I don't think that's going to go away anytime soon.
People who don't hate short sellers see them as a kind of necessary break on irrational exuberance.
All the evidence shows that having short sellers in the market is a good thing. It makes stock prices more efficient. It tends to provide, as you said, a check on irrational exuberance. So while I have no sympathy or pity for the particular short sellers in GameStop and what happened to them, they're big boys. They should have known what they were potentially getting themselves in for, and they were setting themselves up for, you know, a massive short squeeze that could crush them. They should have been well aware of that, even if they didn't know that it was going to be a ragtag bunch of Redditors who were going to send them to the poorhouse. So while I have no sympathy for them, I do think generally we want shorts in the market. And, you know, it's going to be fascinating to see what happens because, you know, if I were a short seller, I would be a lot more nervous about doing it. In that sense, I think it is accurate to say that what's happened has changed American capitalism.
By the way, you want to know how much money I made?
Yeah, how much did you make? I was trying to do the math in my head.
Well, I sold it at 100. So I made $6,500.
That is awesome. Congrats.
On a $975 investment. Of course, it took 22 years.
Yeah, but you know, it's funny. I was talking, my brother called yesterday and I was just joking around and I was like, "Did you buy GameStop?" And he was like, "Yes." And I was like, "What?" And he's not, like, he doesn't have much money and isn't whatever, but he bought it at 60 and he sold it at 120 or something like that. And I was just like, wow.
Now, last time I looked, it was around 270. And I just wonder, why do people keep buying if they know it's just a manipulation based on very little, that gravity will happen and they can't know precisely when?
You know, one of the reasons why it's hard to hold a stock when there's no clear fundamental reason to hold it is that, you know, you're by yourself and you're just kind of, you don't have any idea when it's going to drop. So the sensible thing to do is to sell it at 100. I mean, you know, you could argue the sensible thing to do would have been to sell it at 70, whatever. But I think one of the things that Wall Street Bets does is it actually provides a place where people talk to each other and encourage each other. And so if you go there, you'll see, you know, there are lots of posts saying, "Hold the line, you know, this is going to 1,000. And it does kind of play a role in sort of reinforcing that. But there is something mysterious about it. I mean, we don't entirely know, obviously, who's buying all this stock. I mean, a lot of the stock buying, I think, you know, has been done by shorts who are basically covering their shorts and trying to get out of their positions. And some of it is being done by Wall Street professionals who need to own the stock in order to sell options against them and stuff. But if you look at the volume, I mean, an absolutely incredible number of GameStop shares is trading every day. So there are a lot of ordinary people in there buying and selling the shares. I think some of what's happened in the last couple of days is that there's a lot of day trading in the stock. So people are just trying to ride it up and down. But I think the main thing that's keeping it elevated where it is this Wall Street Bets conviction that there's still more pain that they can inflict on Wall Street. And that's the idea. But I just don't know. That's the fascinating question, is like, at what point does that resolve vanish? It's an incredibly interesting story.
Thank you so much.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
James Surowiecki writes about business and finance. His article titled "The GameStop Fiasco Proves We're in a Meme Stock Bubble" is at marker.medium.org. And that's the show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Micah Loewinger, Leah Feder, John Hanrahan, Eloise Blondio, Rebecca Clark-Callender, and with help from Alex Hainsworth. Zandra Ellen writes our newsletter. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Josh Hahn and Adrian Lilly. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Bob Garfield will be back next week. And I'm Brooke Gladstone.